The Week in Philly on KYW News Radio is recorded and edited every Friday afternoon. For the latest updates to any of the stories you're about to hear, listen to KYW News Radio anytime on your smart speaker or the Odyssey or iHeartRadio apps. Visit KYWNewsRadio.com or follow us on social media at KYW News Radio.
This is The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio. Sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
Welcome to our weekly look at the stories that have been making headlines in Philadelphia and the region. My name is Matt Leon, and over the next hour, we will bring in KYW News Radio reporters to break down the stories you have been talking about. Pat Loeb will tell us about Mayor Sherelle Parker making a change to one of the taxes she is requesting in this year's budget.
She is lowering her hotel tax increase request to 0.6%.
Then we get you ready for Tuesday New Jersey primary elections with Mike Daugherty.
There are 12, count them, 12 Democrats in the primary.
The Philadelphia School Board approves a nearly $5 billion budget.
All of these cuts total about $225 million.
Mike DiNardo will have all the details. Then Kristen Johansson will tell us why three men were freed this week after serving decades in prison for a 1997 murder.
What it came down to, in their opinion, was the medical examiner's testimony.
Chester official. Officials who have been working to make the city safer had to deal with a rash of violent events this week.
The events stretch back to Sunday.
Justin Udo will have that story. And then Vic Ragyapathy tells us how much of a local flavor the U.S. Men's World Cup soccer team will have.
There are four players who are alumni of the Philadelphia Union Academy.
All that is ahead over the next hour. I hope you'll join us for The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio. And we will get started right after this. We start this edition of The Week in Philly heading to City Hall, and there's a lot to talk about. So let's bring in KYW City Hall Bureau Chief Pat Loeb. And Pat, to start, we are still in budget season, and this week Mayor Sherelle Parker made a change to one of the taxes she's requesting. What's the story?
Yeah, the mayor had proposed raising the hotel tax by 2%. She said that would raise $20 million to pay for her goal of ending street homelessness. And the Greater Philadelphia Hotel Association balked. And after several weeks of negotiation, the mayor announced this week that she is lowering her hotel tax increase request to 0.6%. But now she'll also seek a 6% increase in the tax on short-term rentals like Airbnb.
So what's the why here? Is this simply in response to the pushback from the hotel industry?
Yes. I mean, that's the reason she changed her proposal. But it does follow weeks of negotiation. And the head of the Hotel Association, Ed Gross, says his members thought this was about as good a deal as they were going to get. And they're actually happy about the 6% home share tax increase because it levels the playing field somewhat for hotels. And hotels pay like 15.5% tax, whereas the home share rate is much, much lower. From the mayor's perspective, the two taxes together will raise $15 million, a little less than she was going for, but it's compromised to get a deal done. Not that it's actually done. It needs state approval. But the Hotel Association has dropped its opposition. Although Gross says, you know, if you keep trying to balance the budget with taxes on visitors, people are going to start to feel unwelcome. And prices at hotels could go to a place that will discourage tourism.
It's easy to tax the visitors, but eventually that's going to have an adverse effect on our hospitality industry.
So where are we in the process of getting the budget as a whole over the finish line?
Well, from the outside, it looks like there's still a lot of work to do. Even more of a hard sell than the hotel tax is the rideshare tax. The mayor says a dollar a trip will raise $48 million for the school district, which would get it through a structural deficit and avoid a lot of cuts. City Council does want to fund the schools, but very few members are on board with a dollar a trip. Uber's counterproposal was to increase the existing 1.4% tax to a higher percentage, not a dollar amount. I've heard a lot of different versions of what city council might go for, so it's clear that's still in play. And then there are always special projects that council members have. They want more money for the arts, for renewable energy, for parks and rec. So the give and take is in a super active phase right now. They're trying to finalize it by Thursday.
Now, you also had a story on Monday about a Memorial Day ceremony that focused on a monument that really spent decades being hidden. It was really well done. Tell me more.
Well, the monument is the All Wars Memorial for Colored Soldiers and Sailors, and it was commissioned in 1927, which is kind of, for that era, surprisingly inclusive, except that immediately after it was created, the racism, more familiar for the times, emerged, and the Arts Commission refused to put it on the parkway with the other monuments. And so it went into a grassy part of Fairmount Park, a little remote. It was behind Memorial Hall where there was no real access to it. And there it stayed for 60 years. And then a committee to restore and relocate the All Wars Monument formed, and they were successful in getting then Mayor Ed Rendell to put the memorial on the parkway where it now sits on Logan Square, right across from the Franklin Institute.
And that was where the mayor was there to and kind of acknowledge that, right?
Yes, and it was a very moving ceremony with the three remaining living members of that committee that got it relocated there to talk about the work that they did and to see this group of people who've sacrificed for their country, even while fighting for their own equality, honored in that way.
All Wars Memorial stands in honor of sacrifice, service, patriotism, and the ongoing responsibility to tell the full American story.
All right. Thank you very much, Pat. KYW City Hall Bureau Chief Pat Loeb joining us. Just getting started on this edition of The Week in Philly. We've got much more to bring you, and we will start doing that right after this. Welcome back to The Week in Philly, and primary elections in New Jersey are set for Tuesday. And to get you ready for that, let's bring in KYW South Jersey reporter Mike Daugherty. And Mike, of course, last year, New Jersey was really in the election spotlight with that big gubernatorial race that Mikey Sherrill won. Not as much attention this year, needless to say, but there is a Senate race as Democrat Cory Booker will be running for re-election. Any formidable opposition to him building?
No, not a whole lot of drama there. A few candidates were disqualified or dropped out, so there's really no legitimate challenger for Booker within the Democratic Party. So he'll have some challengers for the general, but not for now.
Now, there are a couple of House races that are getting a lot of attention. And first, let's talk about the 2nd Congressional District. That's much of South Jersey. Republican Jeff Van Drew holds the seat. Of course, he was originally voted in as a Democrat, switched parties a few years ago, and has been comfortably reelected a couple of times. 4 Democrats running to take him on in November. What's the state of play there?
4 candidates, and based on the fundraising totals, and I talked with Mike Erasmussen from Rider University, and he kind of sees that as a 2-man race at this point. Cape May Mayor Zach Mulock and progressive Bailey Winder.
We're going to see who winds up on top there. It's sort of the establishment candidate. We've got a mayor. We've got somebody who's known in that part of the district versus a more progressive candidate. And we're going to see what prevails there.
Winder grew up in Princeton and worked both for the U.S. State Department and internationally, and he's pretty well connected in that nonprofit and grassroots space, but he does have pretty limited connections to the actual district itself, so we'll see how that works out.
Now, there is also an interesting race in the 12th Congressional District. What are the details there, and remind us, where exactly is that district in regards to the state?
Yeah, so this is a pretty wild one, and it covers Trenton and north. So we're talking parts of Mercer County, Middlesex County, Somerset counties, firmly in that central Jersey area there, Matt. Bonnie Watson Coleman, Congresswoman, she's not seeking re-election. This is a pretty heavily Democratic district, and there are 12 count them, 12 Democrats in the primary. Some have county institutional support. Some are carving out a lane on that progressive side. We have former Andy Kim political director Sue Altman. She previously tried to run for the 7th district. She lost that race. And there's a Dr. Adam Hamowy, who is now coming under the microscope for his previous relationship with a Muslim cleric who was convicted in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. So this is turning into something to watch for sure.
Now, we talked a couple of years ago about the line going away in New Jersey. Remind us quickly what that means with regards to voting, and could we see an impact from that in these wide open primaries?
Yeah, so the county line system gave preferred ballot positioning to the county supported and vetted candidate. And it was kind of a thumb on the scale. And without that thumb, there's a lot of people who see a path for themselves, see a shot at the table for themselves. And maybe, as Mike and Rasmussen told me, it's not really always warranted.
A lot more candidates are running. It doesn't mean that they've got the ingredients to make it a viable race and a viable win.
Core foundational things like cash and connections, they still really matter. And so we're going to see what works out in that race, because you have a couple of counties that have their endorsed candidates, but then you have some grassroots progressives who have their endorsed candidates. It's going to be interesting to watch.
Now, another New Jersey story going up north. Governor Mikey Sherrill, Senator Andy Kim tried to gain entry to an ICE detainment center in Newark. They were denied at one point. Andy Kim ended up getting pepper sprayed. Tell me more of what happened here.
Yeah, this is like, you know, the ongoing political battle in that neck of the woods in Newark. There have been numerous protests and actions there. You might remember Congresswoman LaMonica McIver, she's still facing charges for allegedly assaulting a federal officer there earlier this year. Newark Mayor Ross Baraka was arrested. Charges were eventually dropped. So this has been an ongoing thing. Memorial Day hit a boiling point again. A protest turned into a not so peaceful interaction there. Senator Andy Kim, I was watching videos. He was trying to keep the peace. He was standing between the ICE agents and a group of people that were throwing stuff at them, and pepper spray was deployed. Senator Kim took some there. It wasn't pretty. He needed to get his eyes washed out. Clearly not a great day over at Delaney Hall.
These are not the people that Donald Trump keeps saying that they are trying to lock up. You know, there is a woman that was pregnant that says she's not getting full OBGYN care. There's a woman that had a miscarriage that said that she did not get the care that she needed and was left to be able to manage that on her own.
What is next here? I would imagine officials are going to keep pushing to inspect, to look into this, right?
Yeah, Democrats are vowing to keep fighting, and they want to have that facility shut down, but they also would like to just get inside and see how people are being treated. They're seeming to think that people are not being treated well. There's reports of people on hunger strikes with inside. The feds, though, they say that the meals are adequate, that the conditions are hygienic, and that they are actually better than most prisons. So we'll see how that works out. Governor Sherrill, though, she's going to keep working, she says, to hold ICE accountable.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike. KYW South Jersey reporter Mike Daugherty. We need to step away. We will have more of this edition of The Week in Philly coming up right after this. It's The Week in Philly, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
A lot of these decisions are not decisions we would want to make ordinarily.
Council is going to take a thorough look on how we get a school board that is responsible and accountable.
While I'm agnostic to how we get the dollars, I do want to note that we desperately need additional revenue.
This is The Week in Philly, and on Thursday night, the Philly School Board adopted a nearly $5 billion budget. For more on this, let's bring in KYW's Mike DiNardo. Mike, what's in it?
Well, what's in it is a reduction in spending to begin to address a long-term structural deficit that the district has. The school district spends more than it takes in, and thanks to COVID relief and the district spending down its surplus, what's called the fund balance, Superintendent Tony Watlington has been able to avoid cuts that affect the classroom in recent years. But that is not true under this budget. There are central office cuts as well as school-level reductions that total 2 $225 million.
What are going to be the results of these cuts, like day to day? How will these be felt by students and people in the community?
Yeah, each school has a building substitute, one sub per school to fill in where needed. Those positions are being eliminated across the board. About 150 teaching positions and more than 100 climate staffers will be reassigned to other schools. Now, the district says no one will be laid off, but it, of course, is always disruptive when teachers and staffers leave buildings where they've worked for some time. There are central office cuts as well. Vacant positions are not being filled, and the superintendent says the district will look to rework vendor contracts that don't directly affect student achievement. All of these cuts, again, total about $225 million.
So the school board adopts the budget. Is this a done deal? Are there more steps?
There are always adjustments that have to be made by the city charter. The district has to adopt a budget by the end of May, but the city and state don't have to have their budgets done until June. So while the school district adopts its budget on anticipated revenues, the numbers don't always wind up once the city and state have their budgets done. So there are always adjustments made afterward.
Now, kind of in a related story, on Tuesday, school principals in Philadelphia rallied in support of Mayor Sherelle Parker's rideshare tax. And the money from that, you talk about that structural deficit, in theory, would go towards that. Give us the details here on this rally, starting with where was it?
This rally slash news conference was in the schoolyard of Potter Thomas Elementary in Fairhill. There were about 100 school principals, members of Commonwealth Association of School Administrators. That's Teamsters Local 502. And yes, Philly school principals are represented by the Teamsters. They called on city council to adopt Mayor Parker's proposal for a dollar a ride tax on Uber, Lyft, and other rideshare trips. It is a tax that the administration says would generate $48 million for schools and help them to stave off the reassignments of those school teachers, counselors, and climate staff.
What are some of the main concerns of the principals of the types of decisions they'll have to make if this tax and the revenue does not come through? I mean, this would be on top of those cuts in the budget already.
Yeah, they're ultimately concerned that student achievement could suffer when you, number one, have larger class sizes, and number two, lose familiar teachers and climate managers to other schools. We talked with Michael Roth, the principal at Olney High School.
They're going to say, I'm done with this. I'm not going to be forced transferred to some other school. I'm going to leave Philadelphia. I'm going to go find a job where I can be for the next 10, 15, 20 years.
What were you hearing from the principals, maybe not during the news conference part, but just talking? Are they optimistic that the rideshare tax will pass? Are they concerned? Like, did you get a feel for what the temperature was?
To be honest, no, it's impossible to say because they are not privy to the negotiations between the mayor's administration and city council. We did ask the head of the union, Robin Cooper, about ways to generate funding.
We think the rideshare tax is an excellent strategy.
You know, many members of city council are still seething over the school board's facilities plan that would close 17 schools. They are not going out of their way to help the district, but again, they do have to get a budget done.
To SEPTA, the transit agency's board has signed off on the opening phases of a big bus route overhaul. What are the details?
Yeah, this is the first time in its existence that SEPTA has done a top-to-bottom redesign of its entire bus network to eliminate redundant routes and those with low ridership, all to create more frequent service. Overall, SEPTA is reducing its, taking its complete bus network from 124 to 106 bus routes using the same number of buses. It'll mean for many riders that their bus stop is moving or their bus may take a different route. What was once a one bus trip may require a rider to transfer to a second bus, but overall, the trip would be faster.
How long until everything is in place that SEPTA wants to do with this?
If you're talking all of the changes, not until late 2027 or even into 2028. They'll be phased in. The first wave of changes is beginning in late August of this year, and then more phases in February and June of 2027. This August is when you'll see two new bus routes being established, Route 72 on Cheltenham Avenue and the new 76 from north to south Philadelphia by way of Frankfort Avenue and Delaware Avenue.
KYW's Mike DiNardo joining us. We need to step away. We will have more of this edition of The Week in Philly coming up right after this. The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers, proud sponsor of the KYW News Radio studios. Bring on the fun and bring home a new Honda with a great deal on your favorite Honda vehicles and finally take that road trip you've been dreaming of. Now's the time to check out the Honda Civic at HRV from Honda, the 2025 Kelley Blue Book's KBB.com best value brand. Welcome back to the Week in Philly. This week on Tuesday, three men were freed after having their murder convictions overturned. Now, this is in connection with the stabbing death of a 73-year-old North Philadelphia woman nearly three decades ago. For more on this, let's bring in KYW Crime and Justice reporter Kristen Johansson. First off, Kristen, give us the backstory here of the stabbing. What happened back in November of 1997?
So as we know it, Essie Mae Thomas was stabbed to death and found by her great nephew. She was living on North Judson Street. Her great nephew came into the house and found her stabbed and actually beaten to death on the floor. Eventually, we know that there was a neighbor who was nearby who says that she saw three men coming out of kind of the back porch area of this woman's home. She identified them as the three individuals. So it's Mark Brittingham, Jermell Schuler, Rashid Smith. They were eventually arrested for the murder, in large part because of this woman's identification of the three of them. She also testified to that. And also because at the time it matched what the medical examiner for the city said, kind of matched up with the whole time of death. And that was really what was at the heart of this case.
Those three men eventually arrested. Do we know who they are in connection with the victim? Was there some sort of relationship there?
What we know is that this was a robbery, or an idea that this was a robbery, that this woman, from what I understand, had recently won some sort of money, lottery money, and that was the thought of why they were robbing her at the time. That was kind of the crux of the whole case, is that she had won money.
Fast forward to this week, what's at the heart of these convictions being overturned? Because, I mean, this is a big deal.
Kind of the way that this sets up when you have these overturned convictions is that the prosecutor shows up and says, we have reason to believe that this was not a rightful conviction. In this case, the media got about a 20-minute heads up that there was going to be a press conference about it. The Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner held that press conference and spoke about really what it came down to, in their opinion, was the medical examiner's testimony.
That medical examiner identified a time of death that was way off, and that was a very important fact because it connected to when a witness claimed she saw three men on the porch.
Now, I have talked to other investigators, both law enforcement and prosecutors, who say that they're really surprised that the district attorney overturned a conviction based on a medical examiner's testimony. There was questions about why the district attorney sought out their own medical examiner versus using a city medical examiner to look at this. Also, that, you know, normally when you get a medical examiner report, you kind of get a range of when they think somebody died, not necessarily an exact time.
They were convicted based upon the testimony of a medical examiner that we have every reason to believe was wrong.
There was a lot of surprise, I would say, from kind of the general community that this was overturned based on that. But that's what the district attorney says that they used to overturn this conviction.
Is there a next step to this, or is this the end of it?
Well, the three have been released from prison, and likely with all of these overturned convictions, it's probably going to be a lawsuit against the city. There's usually a settlement of a couple million at least. We'll be following that case to see whether or not that happens here. I'm expecting it to, because it's happened nearly every other case, and that we're going on about 60 cases now, so it has cost the city a lot of money.
What does the victim's family think about these three having their convictions overturned? Do we know?
So I did try and reach out to the victim's family a number of different ways, and I haven't heard back. But I did speak with the prosecutor who was on this case back when this case was tried in November 1998, when a jury convicted these three. That prosecutor is the political foe, and I would just call it really an enemy of Krasner's and also the prosecutor's enemy. So this is Carlos Vega, who may all remember ran against Krasner back in 2020. 2021 during a Democratic primary. And Krasner has been very critical of Vega. Vega has been very critical of Krasner. He's really surprised by this. And he, you know, questions why, if the medical examiner's testimony was in question, even back at the trial, why the three, he said, prominent criminal defense attorneys who were these three defendants' attorneys, why they wouldn't have brought it up back then if there was such a question about time of death.
Thank you very much, Kristen. We'll keep an eye on this. KYW Crime and Justice reporter Kristen Johansson joining us. Time for a break. More coming up on this edition of The Week in Philly right after this.
These acts of violence are heartbreaking and serve as another painful reminder of the ongoing challenges facing our community. You don't see random acts of violence in the city of Chester. Most people come to this city and never experience anything or even see anything that relates to violence that may have occurred out here.
We are back on The Week in Philly, and a string of violent events occurred this week in Chester, and this alarmed city officials. For more on this, let's bring in KYW's Justin Udo. Justin, first of all, what happened? We're talking about several events, correct? Give us the timeline and the details on what happened.
That's right, Matt. Yes, the events stretch back to Sunday. And on Sunday, there was a shooting, and it was found out later in the week, the person that was shot in that incident ended up dying. Then we fast forward to Tuesday, where there was Tuesday morning, a domestic disturbance call to police, an officer that got to that scene. He was attacked by a person who they say had some mental health issues, and that officer had to go to the hospital, but we're told by officials that they're doing okay. And then later on in the day, Tuesday, we got word that there were a number of shootings in two separate shootings. There were young men that were shot in the head, and both of them were taken to the hospital in critical condition and later on passed. And we know that there were just a barrage of other shootings happening in Chester as well. So this week has not been a particularly good one for the residents and people and the officials in Chester.
Now, how does this fit into kind of the recent big picture when it comes to violence in Chester? Because I feel like they've made some significant progress on the violence prevention front, no?
You're 100% right with that, Matt. I was able to talk with Chester Mayor Stephon Roots earlier in the week at a press conference. And working in Delaware County and following Chester Oak for the last few years, I know that Mayor Roots has brought in a number of different things to the city to help curb that violence. And the numbers have not lied. With their Safe Summer program, they were able to see a decrease in violent gun crimes over like the last 3 years.
Last summer, June through August, there were zero gun-related homicides.
That stretched into even March of this year. There were no gun-related homicides in Chester. So these different initiatives and working with different organizations has really helped Chester decrease its gun violence issues and a lot of violence issues dramatically, drastically over the last few years.
And I know officials were quick to get out in front of what happened this week. I mean, obviously, because it's alarming on its face, but also they don't want this to deter people from coming to Chester because I know they've got a lot of World Cup events set to be held, right?
That's absolutely right, Matt. Chester has played such a crucial role in the development of our state and country, just like Philadelphia has. If you look at Chester's history, there's a lot of firsts you see in Pennsylvania, whether it's courthouses or famous landmarks that Chester is known for. So a lot of America 250 celebrations are happening in Chester this year, as well as you said, those World Cup events that are happening at Subaru Park.
There's going to be added security, of course, from FIFA, from, you know, all the soccer organizations and even our local police force.
They want people to know it's a safe place. It's somewhere you can come. It's somewhere you can enjoy. You can watch the Côte d'Ivoire team practice. You can take part in these America 250 events, and you don't have to look over your shoulders and worry about some violent crime or action happening against you or your loved ones that you're enjoying these events with.
I'd like to dig into the challenge that the city of Chester faces just kind of from its own reputation over the years. I mean, it's had its problems in the past. I'm not trying to say everything is great. They've had serious problems, crime and running the city. But I feel like no matter what progress they make, they're in a space where all it takes is a week like this, and it can push on all the good work they've tried to do. It kind of reinforces every negative stereotype about the city, and it's a difficult cycle to break out of. It's incredibly unfair, but it's difficult to break out of, isn't it?
It's difficult to break out of, but I don't think it's up to Chester to break out of this if they're doing the work, which we've seen in stories that we've reported on over the years that they're trying to do. I think it's more so a mindset of people who don't live in Chester or haven't been to Chester that we have to change. If we go a week in Philly and there's two homicides for a week or for a month, the mayor and city officials would be praised. And Chester is a smaller city, but I think you have to give that kind of grace to the officials running and really going out of their way to implement these things to make it a safer place. So I really think it starts with us, the people who do not live there, to really kind of come and look at Chester with a clean slate and say, you know what? Every city is going to have its issues, but what are they doing to work on them? When I go there, how do I feel? When I go down to Union Yards to watch a game or to enjoy libations with friends, how do I feel when I'm riding through the city and checking out their arts district? How does it look? How do I feel? Not just kind of the hearsay or the things that we have to report, because these things over the last few years have been very few and far between, and as the mayor has called them, kind of outliers. So Chester is not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but I think the work is being put in there by officials, by residents. It takes everyone to kind of look at it in a new light.
Thank you very much, Justin. That's KYW's Justin Udo joining us. Time for another break. We will have more of The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio coming up right after this.
Pulisic, I mean, come on, that's a captain. Guy is tough, never gives up.
Everybody looks like New York or Miami or California's hotbeds, but it's like, no, we have all that talent in this city.
Final segment for this edition of The Week in Philly, and the World Cup is quickly approaching. And of course, Philadelphia, one of the host cities. And this week, the U.S. World Cup team was unveiled, and there is quite the local flavor on the squad. For more, let's bring in KYW's Vic Ragyapathy. And Vic, the Philadelphia Union Academy, very well represented. Give us the rundown of some local players fans might want to keep an eye on.
Yeah, Matt, there are four players who are alumni of the Philadelphia Union Academy: Brendan Aronson, Austin Trusty, Matt Fries, and Mark McKenzie. A couple that might be particularly familiar. Brendan Aronson was a really prominent star for the Union. Matt Fries was actually a spoiler for one of the Union's best chances to win the MLS in 2025. He put up a monster performance in net for NYCFC, a match that ended 1-0, put up a clean sheet against the Union, you know, his hometown team. He comes from Wayne. On top of that, you've also got the most prominent, probably famous American player and one of the greatest American players ever, Christian Pulisic, is from Hershey. So it's a very locally interesting squad and goes to show how big, how much of a hotbed the Philadelphia area is for soccer and soccer development.
It's really impressive for the Union Academy program. Hopefully maybe they can translate that to the actual Philadelphia Union, who are struggling this year, to say the least. Yes. Now, you were at a viewing party for the U.S. team reveal. Where was it, and what were you hearing from people as far as the level of excitement for what the potential of this team is?
Yeah, this was at the pub Tiernanog on 16th and Arch, and there were a couple dozen people there, you know, a few like real diehard fans. I think that, you know, soccer has a reputation in the U.S., a deserved reputation of being, you know, an also-ran in terms of popularity among other sports. But we've seen it grow anecdotally among my generation. I've certainly seen a really heightened awareness and interest in football, especially international footy and following the Premier League or any of the other elite European leagues, as opposed to maybe MLS play or, you know, the U.S.'s international exploits. But I think you're seeing more and more of American players being accepted in Europe, or American players going there for their development. And that all leads to a heightened level of excitement for this U.S. team because, okay, maybe we are developing our talent in the right ways. Maybe our players are proving themselves on the actual stage of football rather than just staying in the U.S., perhaps. But at the same time, the U.S. as a country has never truly put together like a magnificent World Cup run. They're still waiting for something like that, and it's been two decades since their best showing in the modern era of the World Cup. And as we know, American fans aren't the most enthusiastic about soccer in general. So I think there is a level of excitement for this team because of the talent they have. But I also think they need to show the people something to get them really bought in.
All right. Thank you very much, Vic. KYW's Vic Ragyapathy joining us. And that's going to do it for this edition of The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. This week's episode was produced by Brian Seltzer and Sabrina Boyd Circa. My name is Matt Leon. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your weekend.